Fred Film Radio, Locarno Film Festival, Switzerland.
Joining us at this time is director Saeed Teji Farooqi. Hello, Saeed. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
It's a real pleasure to have you on. We'll be speaking about your latest feature, A Thousand Fires, which will be opening the Locarno Film Festival's Critics Week section. And so actually to start off, kind of for the listeners who are not familiar with it, would you like to maybe say a few words about what it talks about?
Yes, it's always difficult to describe, but I'll do my best. It's a tale of oil and life cycles in Burma's hand-drilled oil fields. So it's really, on the surface, it's about a family that tries to make a living out of drilling manual oil fields in Burma. But it's really about the relationship between parents and their child, and it's about growing older and parents learning to let their kids go and ultimately coming to terms with their own mortality and the cycle of life. That's how I feel about it.
And were you familiar with this region before?
No, not at all. Not at all. It was sort of an amazing coincidence. And I've become really open to these coincidences since making the film, because the family and people in Burma in general are very they're very superstitious, and they're very invested in signs and karma and ideas of life cycles. And so, you know, they come to believe that if something feels like a coincidence, it's probably a sign. Mm-hmm. So I had a sort of curious, like a much more intellectual approach to the film initially. I mean, it's a sort of theory to do a film about oil on the fringes of mainstream oil industry, to see what it really looked like on the ground. And through months of just research and coming up with lists of different countries where we could make the film, I was at a film festival for my previous documentary, and somebody showed me a photo essay of the hand-drilled oil fields in Burma that had just been published in the day's newspaper, you know, and sort of said, oh, well, you want to do a film about oil? Have you heard of this? And it blew my mind. I mean, it looked incredible. I had no idea that oil could even be drilled in that way, could be mined in that way. And so we found a Burmese assistant director and just went out there as soon as possible and started filming.
But did you have any problems kind of connecting with the culture and just the place in general?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, this is the film, I would say that this is the culture that's most unfamiliar to me that I've ever worked in. You know, I've worked mostly sort of Middle East and North Africa, and I'm Palestinian. I've lived in the Middle East, so I know that culture fairly well. This was really, yeah, it was a huge culture shock.
So, I mean, when you enter a place like that, what do you look for things that you're familiar with to kind of ease you into the culture at large? What's your approach?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I try, you know, this film took 5 years to make, and that's not by accident. I mean, I try, when I first arrive somewhere, like anyone, you're immediately struck by the differences. I think that's human nature. But I'm not interested in making a film about novelty, you know, or the superficial curiosity of a culture. I really want to make a film about people that's very intense, that's deeply felt. So I spend a long time, you know, sometimes a couple of years, filming the things that I'm initially attracted to, knowing that I'm really just sort of burning incense in a way. You know, it's just part of a ceremony. Yeah. There's a great quote from Francis Ford Coppola, where he says that, you know, he was referring to Apocalypse Now, which of course he kind of shot 1.5 times because he, you know, he started it and then had to ditch it and film it with someone else. But he says he always likens the beginning of his projects to this ritual of burning incense, that these sort of first several thousand feet of film, you know, they're never going to end up in the film. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's part of research. That's part of kind of exercising that demon of many people's instincts, which is you go towards the novelty.
Right.
But if you make a film about novelty, then you don't have people to connect to, because you watch the film and say, oh, look how different people are in Burma. Look how strange people are in Burma. And for me, that contributes to a really unhealthy media landscape. You know, that's the sort of idiot abroad type of filmmaking that Britain excelled at, sort of invented, but it's, I think it's a terrible approach. I don't want to be the foreigner telling you a quirky story about another culture.
Well, even worse, I find kind of like YouTube travelogues too. I find many of those channels are ridiculously superficial.
They are. And there's also, you know, there's, yes, sometimes they're just superficial and uninteresting. Mm-hmm. But on the other extreme, they can also be very racist, you know, even in quite subtle ways. And I recognize my own racism, my own prejudices. So for me, it takes me 3, 4, 5 years to get over those, to understand that family as a family, you know. And we got to a point, I think they would agree with me, where we really felt the love for each other, you know. And they said that to me, and they felt like I was part of the family. And Ten Shui, the father, after I started filming with him for a while and we were getting to know each other, and he said to me, I wonder what brought you halfway across the world to meet me. Maybe we were related in a previous life. That's when I understood the sort of direction the film had to go in, you know, this direction of what I mean, I call it magical realism, but it's a bit patronizing because for them, it's just realism. You know, life cycles are not magical. They're just life. But it was that sense of other layers, that sense of this almost infinite cycle of death and rebirth that the family perceives, that I thought was really important to integrate into the film.
You kind of get that sense from the style. It's sort of meditative, particularly in some instances where you are drawn to the textures and the sounds. They all create this rhythm that seems to suggest something beyond what is on the surface level, what is strictly earthly and terrestrial.
yeah. And that's also, I would say that's also from a fascination that's not even spiritual. I mean, to be honest, I'm a pretty boring, rational guy. I'm really not very spiritual. I mean, I love exploring these aspects of spirituality, but I don't really feel them instinctively. But there was something about the oil and their physical connection to oil that even from a rational sort of scientific perspective is absolutely incredible to think that is the remnants of organic decay, you know, 40 million years of organic decay, that these microscopic plankton and plants and, I don't know, possibly dinosaurs that died 40 million years ago and then became sediment and then underwent pressure transformation. And one day, all these plants and insects that I see around me and my body could end up becoming this material.
Yeah.
And somebody will reach their hand into the ground and extract it, and it becomes fuel to generate, you know, to expand. And it's just an incredible concept. And it's for us, it's for me, that's sort of a 40 million year time scale.
But also a very different look at the oil industry in the way that it's represented, for example, in the Western world. I mean, there's a big jump between the iconic Dallas TV series of rich Texan oil owners and the Burmese family in your documentary that's just kind of trying to survive.
Exactly. And I mean, the idea behind the film initially was to try and find a human aspect to the industry, sort of in quotes, because the industry is just this immense thing that most people don't understand. But, it's everywhere. There's no way. I mean, it's such an insidious industry. There's absolutely no way to avoid it. Everything I'm touching now is inextricably linked to the oil industry. You know, even though I don't, you know, I rarely fly, I don't drive a car, et cetera, et cetera. But every piece of plastic and machinery and food I touch is dependent on the oil industry. So, you know, it's incredible. It's everywhere. Yeah. And so what does it mean to be an individual working in that industry? And there was also a sort of a moral challenge there, which is that, yes, politically, I'm very much against the oil industry, but I also have solidarity with the workers. I have solidarity with people who are equally exploited by that industry, and yet it's their way of life, you know. And I'm talking about low-level working class workers like Ten Shui. I'm not talking about executives who run oil companies.
Yeah.
But I sort of set myself this challenge in the film, which was – how can I feel sympathy and understand on a much more human level what that interaction with the oil industry is like, rather than just immediately dismissing it as, you know, the belly of the beast.
Exactly. I don't think I asked you yet, but how did you actually meet the family, and how did you connect with them?
That it was another case of luck or fate, depending on how you look at it. But I was working with Joshua Minta. He's the one of the assistant directors, and he knows the area. He knows Magway region pretty well. So we would go around and ask for, you know, rumors. Where was the next possible oil field? Where were people moving to? Where was an interesting place? So we spent weeks traveling the country and looking, well, traveling the region, and almost like investigative reporters looking for the next big oil field. And one of these places, you know, we entered an oil field, and it's had an interesting feeling to me. And it, you know, it was, there were also practical concerns. It was accessible. The landscape wasn't so rugged that we couldn't carry cameras through it, that kind of thing. And we came to a crossroads, I mean, literally a crossroads, and there was Ten Shui just digging in his house. And we started talking to him, and as soon as I saw him and saw him smile and spoke to him, there was something, there was some connection there. There was something that I felt familiar with. And so immediately I was really drawn to him, and I asked him if I could start filming. And then very soon, you know, I had the conversation that I have with everyone that I film with, which is, I want to propose this project. Will you, will you collaborate with me on it? So it was really just a very instinctive feeling of understanding with him.
So they were okay with the cameras?
Yeah, and that was another reason why it was enjoyable to film with him, because he was very comfortable in front of the camera. In fact, he didn't really pay it much attention at all.
Yeah.
So, yes, he was okay with it. And of course, I really focus on informed consent, continually informed consent when I'm making a film. So, you know, I explained to him, this is what might happen. This is what I like to film. This is why I make films. I'm going to show up probably every few months and kind of invade your privacy. But in return, I'll also help you out with a lot of things, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, and he agreed, and the family agreed.
I totally admire people like him, because he seems to be the type of guy that just, they live quite a simple life by Western standards, but it is a life where, like, you know, he can, there's not, it seems like there's nothing he can't do. I mean, if something breaks, he fixes it. He seems to be able to adapt to any type of situation, and that's a survival skill that I think here, in the so-called Western world, we very often lack.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I found really fascinating when I was first filming with him, that he fixes everything himself by hand. And I would watch him for hours and hours and hours just trying to, for example, bend one piece of metal to make a part to fix a machine, and just watching that patience, you know, and that kind of, he was so resilient. He would just work on something over and over and over again. And it, you know, his hand's slipping every time, and he gets cut, and he keeps going, and all with this real patience that, you know, I would have lost my temper and just smashed my tools, you know, after a couple of hours. It was incredible. And that really set the pace of the film for me.
Yeah.
The whole thing is this very slow, repetitive, you know, to dig a well, it takes maybe 2 weeks of just hammering the ground with this pipe over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. And it is a beautiful film too, because you kind of get into that flow, and it just really becomes a truly immersive experience. So I totally enjoyed it. Given the things that have happened this year, all the violent conflict in the region, what's it like to look at those images that you shot over the course of a 5-year period, for you personally, but also just considering how people may react to the film in general?
I mean, people there are really suffering now. I mean, it's really depressing and heartbreaking for me. Of course, it's nothing compared to what they're living through. But I think what's worse is that they had a moment of hope. You know, they had sort of 10 years where they felt at least they were starting to emerge from this brutal military dictatorship. And although we lost some hope in Aung San Suu Kyi over the years, but it was moving in the right direction, you know, and there was civil society and there was opposition, and it's just to see it be crushed and people, you know, those streets that I really fell in love with. I mean, I rarely feel that kind of connection with a country. I think it was because of the family. They were so loving to me and caring. And it's just totally heartbreaking. And the sense of extinguishing hope is just criminal.
Yeah.
They're safe. I mean, luckily the family is safe because they live in such a remote area that it's almost not, it's not really touched by any authority, to be honest with you. But yeah, they're so far they're safe.
Yeah. But while you were there, what was it like? I mean, could you see that something was changing for the worse, or did you leave while the situation was still relatively positive and hopeful?
No, I left quite a while. I mean, the last time we were there filming was maybe a year before the coup. So there was no, I mean, I wouldn't say there was no signs of it, because for years it's been known that even the Democratic Party and the whole democratic process was always going to be under the thumb of the military, you know, and they made that very clear. And I think even the lack of progress and you know, Aung San Suu Kyi's denial of the Rohingya genocide, there was always a theory that she had no choice. She was kind of being held hostage by the military. Uh-huh. And my assumption is that anytime she tried to make a move, they would remind her who was in control. That's not to absolve her of any responsibility. I'm just saying that's what the situation I believe in. And then earlier this year, they just had enough. You know, they were always desperate to control the country again, desperate to exert their control, desperate to extinguish any kind of opposition. So you felt that presence there. I mean, you know, it didn't feel like a dangerous place, but you feel that it's not fully transitioned to a democracy. And of course, Burmese people felt that even more. They still had a lot of restrictions on their lives.
I also heard that the film was acquired by Square Eyes, so that's pretty exciting too.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's a really good home for it because they understand the challenges of these sort of weird smaller films. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. My films are generally very odd and hard to sell.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they don't really have a plot because I'm not so interested in plot. They can be quite slow. I think people don't always know how to read them as this, like, I consider them, you know, very political films and they're very much informed by my own background, but people wonder why I'm there. You know, why is a Palestinian British Egyptian filmmaker in Burma? Just a lot of barriers to kind of easy sales, I would say.
How do you feel your Palestinian background helps you connect?
For me, cinema is a form of resistance. It always has been. And, you know, we're lucky in Palestine that we have a really long tradition of not only cinema as a form of resistance, but literally militant cinema. You know, the founders of the Palestine Film Unit were militant fighters who just carried cameras instead of guns. And that was a form of resistance, and it was a form of asserting our identity and our cultural history and our political views and challenging the politics of the occupation and apartheid. So that really informs everything I do, everything I make, because I consider myself very political filmmaker, even though the contents of my films are not, you know, explicitly political with a capital P. They're not party political, but yeah. They're about, you know, this film is very much about human dignity in the face of work. You know, it's very much a film about capitalism and cycles of exploitation in capitalism. And now it just has a different, you know, a much more poignant aspect, which is about the fight for liberation. And there is solidarity between Palestinians Palestinians and the Burmese, and I've had it expressed to me in very beautiful ways by Burmese people. Right. So for sure, it's an essential part of my identity, which means it's an essential part of my films.
Gotcha, yeah. Have you struggled to stay creative and kind of, you know, to stay productive during the times of the pandemic, particularly because as a filmmaker, you travel to all these different places, and that's kind of how you've worked in the past years. But have you had to slow down as a result of COVID?
Actually, it's the opposite. Mm. It's. I mean, we were lucky with the film because we weren't. For example, we weren't just about to release it, which I know a lot of films were about to be released when the pandemic hit. That was a real problem. And we had one more shoot, which we had to cancel, of course, because of the pandemic and then because of the coup. So yes, you know, there was some more filming we would have done, but it wasn't necessary. So in terms of the production side, we were very lucky with the timing. But in terms of the lockdown, I mean, to be honest, I'm not very social at all. I'm quite reclusive. So that time alone was really good for me. And I ended up developing a lot of projects, and now they're coming to fruition. So I got pretty busy. Yeah. Now I'm writing another film, and I'm co-writing another film, and I'm releasing this film. So that time to put everything on pause, I mean, also acknowledging a lot of the pain and suffering that people went through. But that time to put everything on pause was really useful for me. And it also, to be honest, it also put my government in a new perspective for me here. It put the British government in a new perspective.
Yeah.
And I think it's clarified a lot of things for me in terms of my future.
Well, in what way?
I've lost a lot of faith in this country. I didn't necessarily have that much faith in it to begin with. But so, I mean, I've always held the Conservative Party in disdain and distrusted them. Now it's even more, I think, there's just been a certain maliciousness in how they dealt with this that we didn't necessarily see before. You know, they're incompetent, they're corrupt, they're racist. That's to be expected. But the kind of maliciousness that they show, holding people in disdain, has just been absolutely disgusting. And to see that they remain in power and they remain fairly popular, you know, that really pulls the rug from under your feet when you have some kind of faith in revolution or democratic process or radical politics.
Sure. So are you thinking of maybe looking for another place to call, you know, your base?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I don't know how to do it. My dream would be to have, you know, a little cabin somewhere in the mountains, probably in a really warm area. I have some really specific requirements, so this is like a total dream. But it's like
Wi-Fi being one of them, because
it has to have Wi-Fi,
good Wi-Fi connection. Yeah,
it has to have, you know, it has to be accessible to a city, at least like an hour's drive for good coffee and a cinema and whatever,
and running water.
Yeah, it should have running water. It has to also has to be accessible so my family can come visit and stay there when they want.
Yeah.
And then it has to be a warm country. And I'd probably live there half the year and then maybe live here the other half.
Oh, that sounds, I can understand that completely.
I'm sure. I think a lot of people can. I mean, that's the crazy thing is under lockdown when most people were just losing their minds, you know, I was sort of sitting here like, wow, I love this. I love just sitting in my flat alone, no pressure. No communication, just reading, watching films, writing. So I need that isolation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It helps you focus.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, I understand that, yeah. All right, man. So it's been a pleasure, and it's been a fascinating chat. Thanks a lot for joining us. I just remind our listeners that the film that will be screening in Locarno as the opening film of the Critics Week section is titled A Thousand Fires. Definitely recommend my listeners check it out. So thanks again, Said. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a real honor.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.